In today's dangerous world, the United States must again become the world's great persuader, not only its enforcer. That's according to our guests this morning, who say it's time for America to get back to basics. That is, helping people to find meaningful work, a good education, a warm home, and time with their loved ones. And that goes for not only Americans, but the citizens of the world. Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert, with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This morning, The Prosperity Agenda. That's the title of a new book by Nancy Soderberg and Brian Catalis, and they'll be our guests this morning to talk about why the so-called Prosperity Agenda is the best way to win back a leadership role on the world stage. Nancy Soderberg has served as a high-ranking national security advisor and as a U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Her commentary has appeared in publications including the Los Angeles Times, the American Prospect, and the New York Times. Brian Catalis is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where his work focuses on U.S. national security. He's lived and worked in more than a dozen countries around the world, and his commentary has appeared in the L.A. Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe. Well, what do you think? Do you like the idea of the U.S. focusing more on basic quality of life for its citizens and the citizens of the world? Do you think playing good guy for a while will convince the world that the U.S. has earned the right to lead again? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. Nancy Soderberg and Brian Catalis, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. It's actually Brian Catalis.
I was wondering about that. I had a 50-50 shot, and I picked the wrong one. Brian Catalis. All right. Thank you. Well, tell me about the Prosperity Agenda, Nancy. What exactly is it?
Well, it's essentially arguing that the U.S. has to be a driver in meeting the challenges that face the world: debt, disease, poverty, global warming, the food crisis. And by doing so, we'll regain support and trust around the world, and in exchange, we'll get help with our challenges of proliferation and terrorism.
So define what you mean by, you know, focusing on issues at home.
Well, the book argues that we need to not only focus on issues at home — that's the number one challenge of the next president, is to right this economy — but in today's global world, the challenges are global and the solutions have to be global. And so what we mean by the Prosperity Agenda, the subtitle is What the World Wants from America and What We Need in Return. What the world wants from America is leadership. If you look at Senator Obama's visit to Berlin, with an extraordinary 200,000 citizens coming out to hear the candidate for the President of the United States, they want American leadership. They need it. If the lone superpower is on the wrong side of the issues, progress cannot happen, and we've been on the wrong side of the issues. Here at home, we need to address the deficit, bring our troops home from Iraq, resist this tide of isolationism where Americans want to kick the immigrants out and put up barriers to trade. That will make us less prosperous, not more, and drive the solution to global warming, resolving the crises around the world that drive extremism, such as Kashmir and the Arab-Israeli peace process. And we don't have to do it all ourselves, nor do we have to be the world's policemen, but we need to set the agenda. And when we do so, the world sees that America understands their problems and will be much more willing to help us with our challenges.
Well, Brian Catalis, it seems like a fine line. If we're the ones who are setting the agenda again, even if it's an agenda that seems to benefit the citizens of the world, various countries, it's still an agenda that we're setting. I mean, we don't have a lot of capital right now. How do we look like we're not trying to push people around, but in a different way?
Well, I think what we're calling for here is a return to some common sense in terms of our foreign policy, taking care of our people here at home, but then also having a more pragmatic approach that reflects how the world works. So instead of, as we've seen, I think, over the last 7 years or so, we've had an approach that largely was focused on a win-lose, zero-sum strategy that presented the world in this kind of black and white. And what we've seen, and I've seen, most recently came back from the Middle East in Pakistan, when you go to these countries, many people there want some of the basic things that we all want, and many of the challenges that we're facing here, gas prices at the pump that are really high, global warming and other things other people are experiencing too, and the global security challenges are really common challenges. And then rather than focusing on, you know, an us versus them, how do we address these challenges in a way where we restore our leadership by focusing on these basic needs, as opposed to grand ideological debates about advancing freedom and democracy to defeat terrorism. So, you know, we're advocating here a focused kind of common sense approach that goes back to basics. And I think that could be appealing to a lot of people around the world.
Well, what kind of channels are we talking about using here, the UN?
Well, at first, I mean, that's a very important channel, but I don't think we would be exclusive to one channel versus another. And in some instances, when we act bilaterally, and we highlight this in our book, we can do ourselves a lot of good while also helping people in other countries. We argue that probably the finest foreign policy moment for George Bush was our response to both the Pakistan earthquake in 2005 and the Asia tsunami. Very tangibly, people saw our leaders, you know, George Bush sent his father and Colin Powell and former President Clinton over there helping them. And that actually increased our capital. It increased favorability towards the United States in Asia, and it also helped us in Pakistan for a short time. So when we have that sort of focus on those basic needs, we do ourselves a lot of good, and I think we can actually restore our power in ways that military action or some other things might not.
So let's say you're Barack Obama or John McCain. You're just starting out your term. What are the first things you do to sort of engage the prosperity agenda, as you call it?
Well, you know, I think one of the first things we need to do is to address some of the more pressing challenges on national security in different ways. And I think, in fact, the Bush administration has begun to do this in the final 2 years of its administration with a much more pragmatic tone. One that, is, in fact, has tended towards a prosperity agenda, if you will. A lot of people have talked about the surge in Iraq, for instance, and the surge of U.S. troops. But one secret of the surge is that beneath, you know, the increased number of troops and a whole host of other things, there actually were a series of tactics, which we highlight in the first chapter of our book, a series of tactics aimed at focusing on improving the quality of life of Iraqis. Now, certainly, millions of Iraqis still live in dire situation right now, and many are displaced. But it's the sort of tactics that General Petraeus, the current commander in Iraq, tried to use in Mosul in 2003 and used it to some success, but only in a limited degree, that were reintroduced in 2007 and in 2008. So I think, you know, some of it is building on some of these pragmatic steps that the Bush administration has taken, moving away from this, you know, ideological freedom versus terror front and focusing on those basic needs is one thing that the new president can do.
One of my favorite things about this book is that we start each chapter with a story of an average middle-class person around the world and what they need in terms of their own prosperity. So it starts out with a young man in the Congo who's prosperous in his own terms. He has a house and a garden, but he's afraid the war is going to ruin his life. There's Randy Bobulin, Iron River, Michigan, who has trouble heating in his home, and he's angry because he never gets to go out for the occasional steak dinner when he has to sit home and eat hot dogs. And so it shows how all around the world, here and abroad, people want to have the basics in comparison to their neighbors. And I think one of the most powerful stories is about of Captain Brian Freeman in the Iraq chapter, which I'll ask Brian to tell about. But it's very moving. Here's this average guy from America goes to Iraq and does extraordinary things to help change the lives of average Iraqis. And had the U.S. done that from day one using Iraqi contractors, not international contractors, we'd be a lot better off, regardless of what you think about the decision. But, Brian, tell that story because I think it's one of the most powerful in the book.
Well, this is a young man who was actually trained. He's a graduate of West Point and trained to drive tanks, and the U.S. military sent him over there to do economic development, essentially to do a job that someone in the State Department or USAID would do. So, and he actually had his own personal misgivings about the overall war, like many Americans do. I think we're all very divided about whether it was the right thing or the wrong thing. But this was a young man, Captain Freeman, who said, hey, I've got a responsibility, I've got a duty, and I'm going to go do it. And he went over there. And not only, even though he didn't have the training and background in economic development, he went like gangbusters and really went all out to improve the lives of many Iraqis. We interviewed some of his fellow soldiers, and he did amazing things, including working with his wife, who was in Southern California, to get a visa for a young Iraqi boy who had a heart problem and needed treatment in the United States. So they worked to get the visa, and they actually raised private citizen funds. You know, and I think it tells says many great things about Americans that they raised about $20,000 to bring this young boy Ali for his care here in New York. And it's just a wonderful story in terms of how it impacted the lives of people in Iraq that were living south of Baghdad. And unfortunately, tragically, Captain Freeman was killed during his service over there. But his wife met Ali at the hospital in New York and gave Ali her husband's Sony PlayStation and said that this was Brian's, so it's really his gift to you also. So those powerful, moving stories, I think we've seen exhibited at a micro level, many people wanting to serve and do good. And unfortunately, the story in Iraq for several years was that we had a leadership at a very top level that didn't honor those sacrifices and that commitment to service with the right sorts of policies.
So are you saying it's possible to sort of change the world as you go? I mean, even within these policies, which many people don't agree with, like this soldier you're talking about, that within that parameter, it's still possible to attend to these basic things and help people improve their quality of life.
Absolutely, and because we're the lone superpower, we are powerful enough to do exactly that. And we can inspire others to follow us if we get it right. If you look at the polls over the last 7 years, the rate of increase in the levels of anti-Americanism is unprecedented and extraordinary. And when you're trying to convince the world to help us cooperate on gathering intelligence on terrorists or cut off financing for terrorists, and vast majorities of Europeans don't think we're pursuing the war on terror in earnest, or 7 out of 8 Muslim countries think we're a military threat to them. No, we're not, but because they think we are. And when I talk about the Muslim world, it's not the Arab world, but this is Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, the Bangladeshis, the Nigerians. And there's nothing incompatible with our system of life in the Islamic world. I don't believe in this clash of civilization, but because of our policies and our failure to lead in the right way, we've lost the trust of the world. Now, to get that back, we offer a menu in our book about the next president, whether it's Obama or McCain, needs to pursue in order to regain that world's trust. This is not a humanitarian mission around the world that we're promoting. It's very at the very core of American security to promote the solutions to the world's global problems, which are all of a sudden also our problems. Mm. And it'll take leadership. In essence, when you listen to what Barack Obama said in Berlin, he laid out essentially this agenda where we need to, he calls it a dignity agenda, we call it a prosperity agenda, but the substance is very much the same. We need to lead, and others will join us in meeting these common challenges. And if we do so, we'll be much better off. Now, what does that mean in practice? We talked about Iraq. It means helping rebuild the lives of average Iraqis, pulling our troops out.
Can I just jump in and ask if this also means pulling out of these foreign involvements militarily, like in Iraq and Afghanistan?
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. I think we have to finish the job in Iraq and get our troops out. We're on track to do that somewhere in the next 2 to 4 years, whether it's Obama or McCain. Obama will do it faster. In Afghanistan, there is no way to pull our troops out. We need more troops in Afghanistan. I think we had to invade Afghanistan after 9/11. You're always going to have military possibilities. But we're calling for more engagement, not less. And I think the challenge for this election season is to have Americans see that retreating from the world, as some isolationists are pushing for, will make us less safe, not more. And only by this engagement agenda can we keep ourselves safe, secure, and prosperous.
There have been polls that say it's unpopular for the U.S. to be involved extensively in the rest of the world. How are you going to get around that?
Well, I think, you know, you're talking about polls at home with the American public.
Right, exactly.
And I think, you know, you could read these polls in many different ways, but I think there's an overall trend in that most Americans accept that we need to remain pragmatically engaged with the rest of the world, that the 21st century is really a different era. And what I think you see is a crisis of confidence in our leadership. And it's due to some of the, you know, missteps or mistakes that have been made, or some of the tough fights that we've had over the last 7 years or so. We've had a president who has stated some pretty lofty goals, and in some instances, in many instances, we've not achieved those, or we've been pretty slow in achieving those. And that, I think, has resulted in a drop in the percentage of Americans who think that we can solve all of our problems, or that we can actually get things done in this complicated world. And I think with each success, or when we see a gain, like the instance that we talked about in Pakistan responding to the earthquake relief or the Asia tsunami relief, or when we see things like in the diplomatic arena, when we move forward on North Korea and addressing their nuclear program, every time you have a single or a double like this, you know, not a home run, but when you have important gains, that restores the confidence in Americans. And I think, you know, the trend towards isolationism that some people have talked about is a little bit overblown, because I think the overarching theme among most Americans is that, yes, you know, we want to remain engaged in the world. We want to be a leader. We don't want to solve the world's problems, you know, but we can actually be a leader in helping the world act more responsibly and take care of its own affairs.
I'm sorry, Nancy. We'll get that when we come back here. We just have to take a quick break right now. We're talking with Nancy Soderbergh, who has served as a high-ranking national security advisor and a U.S. ambassador to the U.N., and Brian Katulis, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where his work focuses on U.S. national security. Together, they're co-authors of the book The Prosperity Agenda: What the World Wants from America and What We Need in Return. We're hoping you'll call up this morning and tell us what you think about the prosperity agenda. Is it time for the U.S. to start getting back to basics, taking care of improving quality of life issues for its citizens and the citizens of the world? And how do you think playing good cop in the world will play out? Do you think it will convince the rest of the world that the U.S. has earned the right to lead again? You can call us this morning at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickard, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 1 o'clock today, join us for Talk of the Nation. After 1, NPR's Political Junkie talks with Libertarian Party presidential candidate Bob Barr. That's Talk of the Nation at 1 o'clock today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you today as we talk about the prosperity agenda. That's the title of a new book by our guests today, Nancy Soderbergh and Brian Katulis. Subtitle says it all: What the World Wants from America and What We Need in Return. We're talking about policies the U.S. can start to enforce with a new president. Maybe some of it's being done now, but to turn back to basics, taking care of its citizens and also improving the quality of life for people around the world. And we'll go now to your phone calls and take a call from Tom in Milton. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Your guest was talking about doubles. I'm seeing nothing, but we've been fanned all game long as far as, you know, the way it's going. And I think that's because right now the focus of the people the multinational corporations who run most of the world's government, including ours, is not nation-state-based, but it's multinational-based. If you look worldwide, ever since free trade has been the main motivator of the upper classes, middle classes worldwide have gone down the tubes, including ours. And I think anything that basically starts with keeping free trade is going to just, which is corporate trade, not really free trade, is just going to take and not go anywhere. So you have to take and get out of the GATT, get out. Abolish World Trade Agreement, our association, rather, WTO, World Trade Organization, to use the right name, as just a start and go back to bilateral. We were much more successful in building middle classes and keeping out our middle class, because right now we're a third world country. I mean, when you cut it right down the case, I'm familiar with Latin America, and that's why there's a lot of anti-Americanism down there, is because Argentina, Brazil, those places, they don't have a middle class anymore. The hype you see on CNBC and stuff like that is they're doing so great, but it's the 1% they're looking at, and everybody else is in the toilet, basically. And that's my comment.
All right. Thank you for that call, Tom. And Nancy Soderberg, do you want to respond?
That's actually the comment I was going to make before the break, is I think the caller is very accurately reflecting the mood in large parts of America about should we engage in trade or not. And there's no question that increased international trade has hurt huge communities in America. In fact, one of the chapter on globalization talks about two brothers who happen to be cousins of mine from Massachusetts who have lost one job after another to China, and they'd like to put up walls and very much reflect the sentiments of that caller. When we look at it, there's no doubt those people are hurting, and the answer is not, however, to just put up barriers and go back to bilateral trades, because, in fact, I would disagree with the caller's characterization of the middle class. 300 million people have moved out of the middle class in India and China because of these increased trade. Now, so too in America, have we gotten more wealthy? There's a big debate about NAFTA and the pockets there. Overall, however, the statistics show that America overall benefits from this, but there are large pockets of largely manufacturing communities that are hurting. And so the challenge for the next president, and you're hearing this in the debate, is to try and increase trade, raise everyone's boats, but do a much better job of taking care of those communities that are hurt, retraining for the younger ones, essentially a social welfare program for the older ones. But over time, that'll benefit all of America. I think one of the big challenges in this book is to try and convince America to engage on these issues. My own personal peak in the current debate is the Lou Dobbs attack on our immigrant community here in this country. We don't have an immigrant crisis. There are 12 million undocumented workers who should be addressed and eventually put on a path to citizenship. And we need more visas, not less visas, because we need these people to work. When you have the raids on immigration around the world, the factories stop. They're depending on these individuals. These are not al-Qaeda terrorists. There's not al-Qaeda sneaking up on border. But if you listen to some of the rhetoric on the TV and the talk shows, you'd think we were facing an invasion from Mexico of al-Qaeda operatives, and that's just simply not the case.
Let's take another call now. We've got Rick with us from La Crosse. Hi, Rick.
My gosh, I don't know where to begin. Let me start by saying that I don't know if I'm talking with Thomas Friedman or what. Globalization is bad. No nation ever prospered without some measure of protectionism for its industries, okay? That the U.S., Britain, every nation on earth has had some measure of protectionism, and the reason why the Doha rounds in Doha, Switzerland, don't work out is because the third world nations don't agree with the ceilings that the developed world puts up to protect its native industries while wanting to penetrate the third world industries. Okay, that being said, okay, Thomas Friedman aside, do not conflate Postville, Iowa, with this debate. Please do not. This has nothing to do with it. That was a cattle call. It was ridiculous. It was Nazi-like. And the point I'm trying to make is this, that the United States has to get off its high horse, and the people in the United States have to understand that the world understands the hypocrisy of U.S. imperialism, and they do not want top-down globalization. We're talking about the mobility of capital and the mobility of persons. It seems that the mobility of capital is very easy. Companies can, shift operations from one country to another. They can move to China, whatever. But people don't have that mobility. So we're stuck wherever we are. and we can't move. So it's a race to the bottom. We have to deal with whatever the companies impose on people, and that's not just. That is not fair. You know, just think about it. Companies can move anywhere. They're supranational entities. They can move anywhere in the world. They can move their capital, their machinery, whatever. But people can't do that. We can't go to where wages are better or whatever. And so, you know, this is the injustice right now in the world.
Okay, thank you for calling, Rick. And what do you think, Brian Katulis?
Well, I hear the caller's sentiments, and I hear it when I go around the country, and I think it's very real. And, you know, when we talk about globalization's impact on prosperity in the final chapter of our book, we recognize these challenges. I mean, on the one hand, yes, global trade in goods and services has risen from about $95 billion in 1955 to about $12 trillion in 2005. And yes, it's actually lifted many people out of poverty in many countries, but it actually has hit many people too, particularly here in the U.S. We've seen a stagnation in real wages and a whole host of factors. And, you know, one thing that we do talk about is this is a reality, globalization, but it's also something that we need to do in terms of strengthening our safety net for all Americans. This is one of our arguments in the book, that you cannot disconnect domestic policy from our foreign policy approaches. And the one key factor has been that social safety net that we've been lagging behind on. Healthcare is a major issue, and I know many listeners probably are experiencing this, but the rising costs in healthcare. We've got a crisis in healthcare, and until we actually address that and fix America's costly broken healthcare system, we won't be able to compete. We won't be able to provide for our workers in a global economy. And we've really not addressed those issues for decades now. And the rising costs of healthcare are key to our ability to stay competitive in this economy and help our workers stay competitive. So we, you know, a big part of addressing this difficult phase of globalization is rebuilding that social safety net for people here at home, while not erecting barriers in a very real way and moving forward on trade and globalization.
What about Rick's idea that protectionism is necessary for the well-being of the country and has been historically?
Well, I think, you know, my response to that would be that you could cite certain industries that have temporarily benefited in the short run from this, from protectionism. But in the long run, when you take the wider view, when you have more competition and more linkages between different countries in the world, in the long run, everybody's better off. And what we need, as Nancy was saying, and I've been saying, is our programs that help people adjust, help workers adjust to these new realities, and make sure that we actually have not a top-down approach that's imposed by corporations, but one that also is focused on the workers and concerned about their basic needs. And I think in the long run, protectionism has not benefited the overall wealth of the country.
Let's talk to Gary and Merrill next. Hi, Gary, you're up.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
Well, I hope the people will see these two as basically enemies of the United States. First of all, we pay their way. They're on the government dole. Only 50% of us pay taxes. And they want to turn the United States, the people, our thinking, into a kind of relativism where a European family that's lived here for generations, that's paid their way, that's paying the way of these globalists, this president we got now, Clinton, the old man Bush, these people are taking our money, they're dismantling our country, and what they're saying is there's no difference between a family that's been here for three, four generations from Europe and a Somali family over in Minneapolis with 8-10 kids. It's all the same. We're all in the same boat. We should not have pride in our country anymore. Take our money away, take our jobs away, destroy the middle class of America, and then the elitist people like these two will have their way with the world, and we can slosh around and help our third worldism in this country and other countries. There's just no difference, no one kind of people better, worse than the other, just a bunch of third worldism, and it's the destruction of our country. And they know it, but they don't care. They don't have any idea of working and producing something, paying taxes. They don't care about the jobs. It's just a globalism and destroy American culture and, well, enemies of the state is the way I look at it. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary. And Nancy Soderbergh. Well,
yeah.
Go ahead.
I think it's unfortunate that someone would try and personalize this discussion. First of all, neither Brian nor I are on the government payroll. We're both working our way through the economy like everyone else. I think we both have, Brian certainly has roots in, well, I'll let Brian talk for himself, but we both have a lot of roots in average America here today. And what we're trying to argue is that the sentiment that you hear from that caller is going to make America less safe, not more. Where I never challenge someone's patriotism. I would vouch for my own patriotism and resent the fact that anyone would challenge that, frankly. But the challenge here is how do you address that sentiment in this upcoming election? To putting aside the personal attacks, which are offensive, the substance of what he's saying is, you know, don't have America engage in the world, and that, in our view, does not work. That doesn't mean he's any less patriotic than I am. But what I think you need to look at is, yes, the manufacturing base of this country is at risk. There's no question about it. Whether or not we should be competing with the Chinese and the Indians in various manufacturing is the key debate here. I would argue that over time, our competitive advantage is in our brain power and our high tech and our ability to invent things and the sales and the innovation of the American people and ingenuity of the American people. I would bet on that every time that we will win that game. I'd rather have us competing in the global world, because when we compete and compete strongly, America always wins. We're the best and we're the most innovative people out there. And I think it's wrong to divide America into those who came three or four generations ago and those who are coming now. The immigration, were we not to have immigration in this country, our population would be a net negative gain. We'd be losing people. It's what keeps us healthy, vibrant, and strong. So I think he should embrace those Somalis that have moved to Minneapolis and poor things from, you know, must be cold for a transition for them. But they're here. We're looking for a better life. And that's what keeps America strong, and I think it's regrettable that people would see them as a threat.
Brian Katulis, do you want to get in on that?
Yeah, putting aside the personal attacks there, I mean, I know what it means to work. I mean, both of my grandfathers were coal miners in Pennsylvania, and I grew up in a blue collar middle class family, and I have people who are deeply impacted by these changes. So, and I don't want to make this personal, but I just think that we need to recognize that we're in the 21st century and that we're in a different era, that our fortunes are much more interlinked with what's happening on the other side of the world. Just look at the gas prices that we have. This is largely because of an increase in demand overseas. This is demand driven in places like China and India and other places. And we can't simply drill our way out of this problem. It's a short-term solution, if it is a solution at all. What we do need is a much more comprehensive approach that recognizes that our communities here in Maryland or in Wisconsin and other places are just practically linked to the rest of the world, to the rest of the world's security challenges. And I think we need to face that head on and leave aside our anger about a world that's changing and accept that change is inevitable and deal with it, as opposed to try to push back against those changes, because I don't think that works at all.
I'm going to take a quick break right now as we talk to Nancy Soderbergh and Brian Katulis. They're co-authors of the book The Prosperity Agenda, What the World Wants from America and What We Need in Return, about the idea that the U.S. should focus on basic quality of life issues for its citizens and for the citizens of the world, and that is the way to regain global capital to we gain a leadership role on the global stage. The number to call this morning, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We'd be happy to hear from you this morning. You can always email us, too, at talk@wpr.org. Veronica Rickard here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11:45, Hop in Your Canoe. Larry Mueller talks with Doris Green, author of the new book, Explore Wisconsin Rivers. That's Larry Mueller's show starting at 11 o'clock today on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with guests Nancy Soderberg and Brian Katulis this morning. They're authors of the book, The Prosperity Agenda, about what the U.S. needs to do to regain its leadership role in the world to earn that role back, and that is focusing on basic quality of life issues for its citizens and the citizens of the world. And let's go and take another phone call now. We have got John on the line from Madison. Hi, John.
Good morning. It's always a pleasure to hear from people who are trying to understand and discuss issues that no one seems to discuss in the election agenda. And I have two comments. One is I just want to follow up on the previous caller's comments about the mobility of labor and capital. And I was just calling in at that point, so I might have missed a few responses. But I think having traveled around many countries in the world, actually, and I've seen there are different approaches to immigration, and some are very open, some are very closed. In general, the countries that are open to immigration seem to have the most growth right now. And I think the overall idea of free trade has to encompass free immigration effectively, which is a very difficult concept for, I think, most Americans to grasp. But I think unless we do that, the equation of economics behind free trade is going to be very unbalanced and ultimately lead to the kind of problems we're facing right now, where people are not benefiting from this expansion as much as the corporations are. And this goes both ways. Americans moving to other places, which I think is something that we don't really consider, but, you know, there are other places that are growing much faster than ours. And then also letting other people move here and filling voids that definitely exist. I would consider that part of the prosperity agenda for the world. Let people take advantage of what America offers. And okay, they might not be Europeans. They may actually be Europeans. You know, there could certainly be plenty of Europeans who'd want to move to the U.S. if there was the opportunity to do so. So I think that's one of my comments. And then the other one is a more philosophical one. In general, I think I would agree with your idea of prosperity for the world, but practically speaking, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And the question is, how are we going to strike the right balance of avoiding creating a welfare state for the rural? You know, it's very easy to misinterpret your idea as, well, let's just throw money out there and hope that people like us as a result. And I don't think that's what we want to do, but it's the easiest thing to do, effectively. And in many ways, that's what we have done with these natural disasters that people seem to think, you know, very well of us, but ultimately they're just throwing money at people when they're in need. But that's not a long-term strategy, and it's not feasible practically, you know, on a large scale. We can't pave the way of the world. We have to make sure that the government, and you know, how do we know that the government is really going to carry out this kind of strategy in a sensible, practical, financially feasible manner? So that's my comment, and I'll take the answer there. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, John. And Nancy Soderberg.
Well, first of all, thank you for that thoughtful comment. It's refreshing. I think the challenge here is for the next president of the United States is how do you manage all of the basket of issues that caller raised? We have not gotten it right. I think it is the top in America has benefited. But I do think we need to have something of a redistribution down towards the middle class in a way that will help those who have been hurt by globalization. The rich can handle the price of gas at $4 or $5. The middle class cannot. And so we need to have innovative solutions that across the board that will address problems here at home, frankly, by driving the prosperity both at home and abroad. Now, I think the caller rightly says there's a risk that people will dismiss this book without reading it and say, oh, it's the welfare program for the world. We can't afford it. Why should we bother? It's not our problem. And what we're saying is the opposite of that. This is not a welfare program for the world, but rather an America that's leading in the challenges, which is the major conflicts around the world. You know, it's been 7 years where we've been sitting on the sidelines of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The administration is engaging now, but frankly, it's too late and too little. It'll be in the inbox of the next president. We're not going to resolve the issues between India and Pakistan without addressing Kashmir or the broader proliferation issues. The global warming is a real problem. It's time to face up to it and have a serious energy policy, which we've been lacking. And so there's a range of issues that we don't have to pay for ourselves, but we need to set the agenda. President Bush, frankly, has provided an extraordinary amount of level of aid to Africa and the fight against HIV/AIDS, and he's frankly gotten very little credit for it, but he's been out there fighting that, and we haven't gotten any credit for it because the other policies have obscured that. So we are actually quite generous on some levels already. So we're not arguing that we have to vastly increase our funding in most of these areas. Some, yes, but broadly it's setting the policies, putting America on the right side of some of the solutions here, and then the world will begin to follow us. Now, some will resist that as pie in the sky, but the book demonstrates examples such as those that Brian had mentioned on the Pakistani and tsunami aid relief. It works when we get it right, and the world recognizes that, and that's what we need to do beginning next January.
If I could add, I mean, I think, you know, let's be clear, we're not talking about a welfare program for the world, and quite the contrary. And I think a precise example of this would be the case in Iraq. Unfortunately, we've not had enough accountability and transparency for the amounts of money that have gone over there. And then more importantly, we've had this blank check when we see that the Iraqis themselves have a great deal of resources, especially with oil now hovering at around $120, $125 a barrel. The Iraqi government projected revenue of about $35 billion at the start of their budget year. That's going to be about double because of the price of oil. And a big part of the problem is that we've not held other governments accountable and responsible for actually using their resources to make life better for their own citizens. You've got a serious problem, which was highlighted in a report released this week by a Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, essentially saying that the Iraqi government has only spent about 2.7% of its capital budget on its own people. And this should raise a lot of questions for U.S. taxpayers as to why we're supporting so much of our, you know, $10 to $12 billion a month in Iraq when the Iraqi government itself is not spending money on its own people. And I think when we talk about a prosperity agenda, a key focus for a new administration in Iraq is not to spend more money like a blank check like we've had for the last 6 or 7 years, but to get the Iraqis and, frankly, their neighbors, who are quite rich with oil resources, to spend their money more wisely and actually benefit their people.
Well, I think some of what we've heard this morning has been a reflection of the results of America dipping its toe into the global economy, and sometimes the results haven't always been favorable. I think some people feel a little burned by that, and also from the current state of the U.S.'s status in the world at large, this might be a hard sell. How are you going to convince people of what you're talking about at this particular juncture in time?
Going on shows like this and talking to your great community is one way to do it. But I think if you read the book, we go through real people who are impacted by this and talk about their real concerns. And I think this will be part of the debate of the election. I mentioned earlier Obama's speech in Berlin. Essentially, he's arguing that we need to engage in these challenges, not because it's a welfare program, not because it's the nice thing to do, but because it's the smart thing to do. If you look at, for instance, the food crisis right now that's going on since last October, food prices have skyrocketed up around the world. Why is that? If you look at it, the solutions are very complex. There's no easy solutions to any of these, and they're multifaceted. There's been this confluence of events, some call it the perfect storm, of rising fuel prices, a drought in Australia, floods in the Midwest, the fact that governments the rice and wheat crops are failing around the world is driving food prices up and risks throwing 100 million people back into abject poverty, according to the World Bank. What that means is that you'll have more people with poverty, crisis, violence, all of these things now threaten the United States. So we need a multifaceted approach to engage the world on these issues. And that's going to be a lot of the debate. Some of the callers that want to, that we heard this morning, that want to throw barriers up because they're fearful of globalization. Globalization is tough. There's no question about it, but it is not going away, and we need a multifaceted approach to address it. And the only way that that's going to happen is leadership at the top of the lone superpower in the world, and that's the United States. And that's the challenge for the next president and the debate that we'll have in this election.
Does it have to happen all at once? Is there the possibility, do you think, of letting us retreat a little and lick our wounds, focusing on domestic issues before we start such a sweeping agenda?
Well, Brian, you take that one.
Yeah, I think, again, and I can't stress this enough, that many of our domestic challenges are so interlinked with what we're facing in the world. And I highlighted just the healthcare need and the need to reform healthcare so that we can remain competitive in the economy, that you can no longer, I think of public policy simply as one that is disconnected from what's going on outside of our borders. Our economy is much more interlinked with the economies of countries around the world ever before. And yes, we do need to, I think, invest more in particular, as I mentioned, healthcare, but then also our infrastructure. We saw in many instances around the country where we've really underinvested in our infrastructure, and that has a direct impact on our ability to compete, has a direct impact on all of our quality, the quality of life of all of our people, and we need a stronger focus. And frankly, we just haven't had a focus. Unfortunately, much of the public policy agenda under the Bush administration, I think, has been shaped by the response to 9/11, which was very legitimate, and we needed to take action. But then I think this sidestep into Iraq, which really I can't stress how much it's drained not only our ability to shape our foreign policy in other areas, but also it's distracted us from some of these attentions here at home very tangibly. You know, we have National Guard units that should be here at home to help deal with natural disasters and other things, and they're simply not there. And we need to rebalance. And I think part of rebalancing is, yes, licking our wounds and taking care of our own, but doing it in a way that recognizes that we can't just throw up barriers and say goodbye to the world.
I think we've got time for one more call here. Let's take Joe from Wautoma. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. I have three comments I'd like to make. Number one, I don't think Americans can compete with countries like China, where the workers in the factories make $1 a day, you know, where they have a different economy than we do. On the other hand, the United States has the deepest underwater aquifer, the deepest amount of topsoil, and the mildest climate. I think we should try to do what Japan did in the 30s, increase the agricultural output by about 17%, and become the food source of the world, where we could possibly, if oil goes up to 150 a barrel, or 200 a barrel, or 300 a barrel, we could raise the price of a bushel of wheat to $40 a barrel. Now, you know, we wouldn't want to see anybody starve or riot over those prices, so we could give it to these countries on credit, and they could owe us either goods or services coming back. That way, people who are making $7 an hour in the agricultural business could make $15 an hour and have a sustainable a future wage, not a wage that they cannot foresee any kind of constructive future. So I guess I would say that it's kind of macroeconomics. You know, everybody's talking about, well, like, I remember Governor Dole saying that they sold the computer systems to China and so forth, and it was great for the trade balance. But the fact is that those computers are just going to be used in manufacturing to undercut American jobs, number one. Number two, to get the kind of brains to do the research, to develop the kind of high-tech computers they do in Madison, you need nice roads, nice hospitals, you need opera houses.
Joe, I want to leave it there so that we can make sure our guests get a chance to respond. Brian and Nancy, we've got about a minute left. Nancy, do you want to take this one?
Well, I think he was getting to what we would agree with at the end there, which is the challenge is how do we compete against the Chinas? And it's not in building widgets, because we can't compete with their dollar, you know, day wages, nor do we want to. The question is, how do we make sure that we have the best education system, the best healthcare system, so that we have an American workforce who can be innovative and competing in what I would call the 21st century economy?
I'm sorry, Brian, are you there?
Yeah.
You got about 20 seconds.
20 seconds. Well, again, I actually heard a tone of confidence in that last caller's comments, which is something I have, and I think we all have to have as a country. You know, we've gone through rough spells before, and this is a very difficult phase. And I think if you read the book, it is one that is imbued with confidence that, yes, we can actually address these challenges and do it in a way that isn't angry, but goes back to the greatness of our country, you know, our core values and the hard work and the decency that we are. And I think his ideas are interesting to start with and something to work with, but I think we need to actually have more confidence in our ability.
Okay, thank you both so much for being with us this hour. I appreciate your time.
Great, thank you.
Brian Katulis and Nancy Soderberg, the author of The Prosperity Agenda. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network.